Friday edition of the Ion College Basketball Podcast. Thank you for coming back in. And yes, that is a typical, normal introduction, what you're used to, that terrific old school CBS college basketball theme song. Instead of me playing guitar, which was unfortunately the situation on Wednesday's podcast, if you have not yet listened, I can spare you that. But if you want to, Goodman and Parrish on Wednesday finally got me into a corner, and I whipped out the axe and serenaded him a little bit. But on this version, I'm bringing back on a really, really smart guy and who is the perfect guest for the current temperature of college sports. John Infante writes the Bylaw blog, as he has for so many years, and does so for athleticscholarships.net. And if you follow me on Twitter, you should be following John as well. It's at @John_Infante, John with an H. Infante is Infante. I'll get to why he's on here in just a second, but I'm going to shut up and let him say hello to everyone. So how you doing, buddy?
Good. How's it going? Now, was that an acoustic version of the CBS theme?
No. Okay. So, no, it wasn't. But I do know some of that theme. Like, I was debating, should I do that? And I think at some point, like later in the season, I'm going to do it. But no, I did the Beatles' "Hey Bulldog," and then I closed it up with a Stevie Ray Vaughan acoustic number. So, no CBS theme. But I'm working on it. And when I put it on Twitter that I was going to play a little guitar, I had probably about five people respond, play One Shining Moment, and I think I'm gonna save, like, I have to learn it, and I think I'm gonna save that for like the last podcast of the tournament or whatever, something like that. So yeah,
no, I think the acoustic CBS thing would be perfect for maybe, you know, the off season podcast.
Yeah, I know exactly
the lighter side of Ion College Basketball.
That's a great point, man. I got to work out a nice little arrangement on that. So John is my go-to source, and pretty much every sports writer's go-to source whenever there are NCAA issues that you see crop up. Opinions are put out there, and sometimes those opinions are based in things that cannot be or aren't factual or misleading, and John is a very good hall monitor, and I say that with a total complimentary tone because we need it. So with the Miami stuff and the NCAA kind of putting egg all over its face, it's time to kind of address what the situation is here, where we are going to go forward, and there's a few pretty big issues. I mean, we'll get to it later in the podcast. There is a proposal out there, an idea that kids will be able to transfer if they've got a 2.6 GPA or better, and we don't know if that's going to be or if that's not. I'll ask John about that in a little bit. But let's go right to NCAA, Frank Haith stuff. I'll put Haith on the back burner and go straight to NCAA. How you've seen a lot of people take shots at the NCAA for what they've done here, and now is investigating its investigation, and we're waiting for the totem to fall over and realize if we're incepted or not with this whole thing. But is this, I mean, how embarrassing, in your opinion, is this for the NCAA? How bad is this? Because I tend to, like, I understand the schadenfreude. Like, I totally get it. But I also oddly, like, give credit to the NCAA for being as, hey, are bad, this is freaking terrible. Like, I give them credit for at least getting out in front of it. And us, as someone tweeted, and I forgive me for not being able to cite who it was, but, you know, we could have found this out down the road in some sort of lawsuit, but immediately they put this out there. So what's your take on just how it's gotten to this point from an NCAA perspective?
Well, I think when you look at what they're dealing with Todd McNair and the USC case and his lawsuit, you're exactly right that, oddly enough, this is improvement on the NCAA's part, that they're catching this problem before a notice of allegations was delivered, before they, you know, started making specific accusations against people in a school based on information that they shouldn't have gotten. But the one thing you can't ignore is that this is really serious. And Jay Billis, a couple guys over at SB Nation, pointed out that by going into a legal proceeding where people are under oath and by trying to obtain subpoena power that they don't have, you raise the specter of, as remote a possibility this is, that someone would go to jail if they lied to the NCAA. And that is specifically not the power the NCAA has, and specifically not the power the NCAA is supposed to have. So again, kudos to them for catching this. Kudos to them for being up front. We can only right now hope that continues. I know transparency with the NCAA is a two steps forward, one step back. I think they're getting more transparent, especially when they have a problem and they're working on it. But it's not nearly what everybody would want them to be. I think everybody wants them to be completely open and completely transparent about everything all the time. And this would be a good start if they kept with the sort of theme that they started with yesterday of having, you know, the head honcho, the president of the NCAA, get on a phone call and take the questions, you know, the abuse, if you will, from the media on what happened. And let's hope that continues with this investigation and the report and the changes that they're going to make as a result.
There's been a few people that have pointed to Emmert and said, listen, you know, and Billis is one of those people, you would point to a coach if, you know, the situations aren't entirely comparable, but if, you know, you get what I'm saying, like they'll point to the coach and make him take the fall in a certain situation. Is it reached a point with Emmert right now where he should feel like his job as NCAA president is in jeopardy? Do you think it is? I mean, do you think in 2 years he'll still be the president?
I think we're getting to that point. I think that he has become a kind of lightning rod for controversy. I actually have a post coming out about this tomorrow. I think the best way to answer that question is yes, his job is probably in jeopardy at this point. Yes, I don't know if he's going to survive two more years, but I don't know who would have done a better job. If you consider the type of people that would be NCAA president, which now looks like it's drawn almost exclusively from the ranks of NCAA insiders or college presidents, something like this was kind of bound to happen. I mean, the NCAA goes through periods of scandal, periods where not just the schools are breaking rules, but the association itself looks bad with, you know, when they lost the lawsuit about television rights, when they had to fight to take over women's sports, SMU and the changes to the enforcement process that came out of that, the Jerry Tarkanian case. I mean, we can go through all these, and they kind of come at a pretty regular interval. So it wasn't just the schools that kind of, you know, hit a breaking point. I think this was probably going to come no matter whether it was Mark Emmert, whether Miles Brand was still with us and still president of the NCAA, or if one of the other people that they had considered before hiring Emmert was in charge.
Why would anyone – all right, let's just play the game here, the hypothetical. Let's say Emmert, you know, let's say he's not there in a year. What is the motive for anyone to take the job as NCAA president? I'm sure it's a fine paycheck, but there just seems to be so little upside from a PR standpoint. I mean, as you said, total lightning rod. I see that forever happening. You know, I read Dan Wetzel on Yahoo Sports turning this latest embarrassment for the NCAA into, listen, like this is just, you know, it's a bit of a sham that that players, he made it into a pay the players kind of argument. Spencer Hall and SB Nation, very, very good writer, basically just ripped the NCAA to shreds and said, you know, it's basically a disease. And that's what he referred it to as and wished it would go away sooner rather than later. So what's the motive for the NCAA or the ability to even get a leader to change things? Because the consensus among a lot of writers who I don't even think are unnecessarily jaded or cynical is that the NCAA ultimately is just there and slowly, slowly decaying.
Well, I think for starters is that just like I think we might ask the same question, why would anyone take the Kentucky basketball job? You have the crazy fans, the high expectations, the constant scrutiny. I think it's the same thing of it is one of the biggest challenge in either sports or college athletics or sports or higher education. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, that's why it's attracted guys who are – very secure as college presidents like Mark Emmert, Miles Brand, Cedric Dempsey, who was the AD at Arizona before he became president of the NCAA. If you look at the two people, for instance, that were the other two finalists when Emmert took the job, it was the superintendent of West Point, which, you know, among jobs either in the military or higher education, that might be considered one of the most prestigious in both those fields. And a senior, you know, basically like a senior vice president executive at Ernst & Young, I believe, or one of the accounting firms, who was a former women's basketball player at Purdue. And these are people who wanted this job, you know, back in 2009, 2010, when, granted, the NCAA was a little better off, you know, from a PR standpoint at that point, because I think after you know, Miles Brand tenure, he kind of got the NCAA back to a sort of educational roots. Now, granted, that's not a universally popular agenda. There's plenty of people who want to see the NCAA get away from that and become more or less just, you know, a sports league that runs championships and has some basic rules about how many people can be on the team at one time. But I think it's still the ultimate challenge. It's still considered within academia as being a very prestigious position. And like you said, the fact that it's a seven-figure paycheck isn't dissuading many people from taking it.
Yeah, there's an interesting irony there that the academia types, and yet it's the big paycheck. You know, a lot of us will chase after that. I don't know. Well, we'll see. I agree with a lot of points that have been made by some scribes, and we don't need to harp too much on the overall state of the monolith right now, because we got a lot to get to. We will transfer over to Frank Haith right now. Is Frank Haith coaching Missouri in 2 years, in your opinion?
That's hard to say because, you know, I think the declaration of victory by Miami fans or by Missouri fans or the other fans of schools where these former Miami coaches are, I think is a little premature, because while we know that some information and probably some violations will be knocked out of the case as a result of this scandal, we didn't really know what was in it in the first place. If they had managed to corroborate more or less everything in Yahoo's original report and are only knocking out a small fraction of that, you still have one of the largest and most complex and most serious violations of NCAA rules in, you know, since about SMU. We also know through some of the reports that they may have verified some of the allegations against Frank Haith through a source other than these bankruptcy proceedings, which would mean that they would stay in the case despite this misconduct by the investigators. So I really think it depends very specifically on what the allegations are against him, how many violations he's found to have participated in or that were committed by his staff, what steps he took to prevent that. And that leads to the severity of the show cause order, which is no longer this kind of one single thing where you were involved in NCAA violations, so the NCAA is going to tell any school that wants to hire you, you need to come talk to us and we'll sort of decide if you're serious enough about having him and having this coach and what sort of penalties you're going to take for doing that. Now it's in the report, in the penalties, in the show cause order that's given down, it tells schools who would want to hire or retain these coaches exactly what they need to do, exactly how the coach needs to be monitored, and exactly what the restrictions are. So it could come down to a situation where Frank Haith is given, for instance, a one-year show cause order where he can't recruit, and it's up to Missouri to decide if they can deal with their head men's basketball coach not being able to recruit for 1 year, and if he's a good enough coach in other respects to weather that penalty.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very important distinction to realize, and just want to touch on what you said and make emphasis for it. You know, in Goodman's report, in Goodman's reporting, I'm not going to speak totally for him, but it is very critical for Missouri fans to understand that there stands the chance and the possibility and the reality that the notice of allegations that could eventually come down on Frank Haith could be there because information could have been discovered that has nothing to do with the bankruptcy case with Nevin Shapiro's lawyer. And if that's the case, then the NCAA can still proceed as planned, albeit it will be delayed because right now the NCAA is investigating itself. One other quick Haith thing before we move on. Why is it that the NCAA can, you know, to its own admission, it hopes to wrap up its own internal investigation of this investigation in the next week or two? Why can it do that so quickly, but the UCLA thing will be going on 2 and probably 2.5, 3 years to wrap up?
mostly because the NCAA can make its own people talk to it. And, you know, this gets back to exactly why we had this whole mess in the first place, which is, you know, there's a bunch of people that the NCAA wanted to talk to and needed to talk to who the NCAA does not and probably should not have any power over. Mm-hmm. They can't compel anybody, or they shouldn't be compelling anyone who doesn't want to be involved in college athletics to talk to them. They have no tool to make the, you know, no penalty to hold over those people's heads. The only people that they, you know, have this power over are coaches and student athletes and administrators who if they refuse to cooperate with the NCAA are going to get a charge of unethical conduct and get a show cause penalty, or in the case of a student athlete, lose their eligibility and not be able to continue being involved in college athletics. The people, you know, involved with the NCAA, you know, they have one of those things to hold over those people, which is you'd think those people are probably going to be fired, but if you don't help with this investigation, you're definitely going to be fired.
Oh man, and sometimes when you just like when you hear how you just described it, and you step back and you're like, man, sometimes I just think the NCAA is just so. In so many ways, pointless. But it did have a convention in Dallas this month, last week, in fact, and that had a lot of important things within the context of what the NCAA hopes to do and will do and has done. So you want to break down why this convention was critical and what came from it and changes to come?
Well, the whole first step that the, you know, what the NCAA did at the convention was take a first step through a sort of grand rethinking of the rule book, which is, you know, not, you know, people shouldn't get their hopes up. It wasn't, you know, a discussion of how we start paying players or, you know, how we get rid of academic eligibility requirements. It was slimming down the rule book, getting rid of some of the petty violations so that the NCAA can focus on enforcing its more, you know, its core principles, its more serious rules, and going after, you know, more serious violators of those rules rather than the coach who accidentally texted a player or the school that called a recruit too early or too many times. So most of what of the very significant rules that were passed there actually don't really apply to men's basketball because it was all passed as a part of a complete men's basketball recruiting overhaul last year at the NCAA convention. So more or less what happened is a lot of the things that were passed for men's basketball last year are now going to be applied to all sports. Although there were a couple of changes that weren't in that men's basketball recruiting model, specifically the rule change that's starting in August, anyone who works at a school rather than just the coaches will be able to call and text recruits or watch recruiting film or rank and evaluate prospects as long as they, you know, don't go on the road to do that.
And now the slimming of the rule book, which hasn't really truly been slimmed yet, that was a bit of a talking point, something people had noticed. What's pragmatic here? I mean, how much realistically can the NCAA cut from its tome? I'd seen the figure 5%. Looks like they that's you know realistic right now. You know, some people would prefer it was chopped in half. Is that a pipe dream?
I mean, I always laugh when people talk about the actual number of pages in the rule book because the NCAA cut about a third of the rule book out if you look at the actual physical book simply by not printing some of the rules in it and just requiring you to go look it up online. I mean, we could have a 50-page rule book. You just need a magnifying glass to look through it.
Yeah, I get you.
You know, I don't think the idea is necessarily to have less rules. You know, certainly if I told you I have a foolproof bulletproof plan to pay players in this 400-page rule book, I think most people who are asking for a slimmer NCAA rule book would say that's a fine compromise to me if it just means, you know, if it just means there's a lot of printing to be done. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's not so much to slim down the number of rules as it is to make it the rules more, you know, easier and predictable, and again to get out of the business of policing these kind of petty things like the number of phone calls or you know, what mode of communication you're using at a time. You know, if you send an email to a kid who has it on his phone, it's different than sending a text message. Just stop getting mired in all that, those kind of meaningless distinctions, and again, focus on more important things. Now, what happened at this convention was pretty much what a lot of people would regard as low-hanging fruit. It was kind of pain points in recruiting, monitoring, and frankly, a lot of things that were already going on that weren't allowed that are, you know, just not going to be violations anymore. It's really next year where we start to get into more significant changes, talking about, for instance, allowing schools to just feed athletes as much as they want, whenever they want. That's going to be a big fight because it's a big budget item. It's another place where the haves and the have-nots are going to be further torn apart. But that's one example of more significant things about student athlete welfare that'll be coming over hopefully this year and then the following year.
But the cream cheese is allowed now, right? I want to be clear on this because this is obviously a folly of a jab at the NCAA. But the spreads on bagels and other assortment of starches, this is now allowed, or are we still waiting on a year because it ties in with the whole feeding players as much as teams want?
No, so this is allowed now, just the one starch, though. It's still just bagels. They didn't.
Is it really? It's just bagels? Are you kidding me? So wait, hold on. Toast is not involved in this? Are we kidding here?
No, no toast. So
I'm not getting anywhere here.
So the rule that was passed was, you know, and the quick little history of this is that the NCAA had a rule about nutritional supplements, was that you could give athletes basically energy bars. And a couple of years ago, I believe it was the ACC said, energy bars are full of junk. It's basically glorified junk food. We might as well be feeding them, you know, Snickers bars and soda pop. So let's give them actual real food. And the three things that they put as actual real food were fruits, nuts, and bagels. So that rule was passed, and then the NCAA staff and the committees that sort of have to interpret these rules said you couldn't put spreads or toppings onto the bagels. And they also said you couldn't use the fruit. It had to be whole fruit. You couldn't come and say, well, I'm giving them fruit. It's jelly.
I mean,
so they deleted that interpretation. So now you can put whatever you want on a bagel. Although I'm pretty sure there's going to be a football or basketball, players lounge that's going to have grilled steaks that they are going to say are, you know, toppings for the bagel.
I mean, this is the crap people are talking about. Like, what are we doing? This is just a waste of time. But I won't continue harping on it. Was there anything else tied to the new recruiting legislation that is now active for college basketball? I know you touched on that real quick, but was there any more nuance that you wanted to let people know about so fans can understand what their coaches can do and what their juniors and seniors in high school are able to do as well?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes, you know, men's basketball now, they can basically call or text any junior or senior in high school as much as they want. And that's been going on since last January. One of the big changes now that started on January 1 is that juniors are now allowed to take official visits, the paid visits to campuses. The one caveat is that players still only get a total of 5 visits, and schools can only offer, I believe it's 13 visits per year. So it's a much more strategic kind of thing now where, a player has to decide, do I want to get in a couple of my visits earlier to schools, knowing that, you know, I can't go back to those schools on an official visit. And if I use up my 5 before I finish my junior year and then I, you know, blow up in my last AAU season, I might not have the opportunity to visit, you know, a new set of schools that's recruiting me later in the process. At the same time, schools are probably having to decide, do we spend some of these limited visits on juniors and sort of get them earlier, or do we save it as our big push with seniors after we've had a longer chance to gauge their interest and evaluate them?
Okay. That's fairly big and certainly a step forward because, you know, as tempting as it is, it can be to cheat in recruiting, and it definitely happens. I feel like broader interpretations are really just more true to what's actually happening. They would only help the healthiness of the state and of college hoops in general. That's just my personal take. I wanted to talk with you about transfers. This is a big one. Haven't had you on since you actually broke the news, you little scoop. You scoop master you. So if you're listening to the podcast, this might ring a bell. If not, well, it's damn interesting. There stands to be the possibility that if a player has a 2.6 GPA or better, he or she will be able to transfer to another school and not have to sit the requisite 1 year redshirt season. It's an interesting bar to set, and I think there are a couple ways to view this. I want your opinion on if this is going to happen, and then your opinion on if it's good for college athletics if it comes to be.
So looking at the state of this idea right now, which is that it's not yet a formal NCAA proposal, but it is supposed to be, the plan is to have the board of directors adopt something this August. So, you know, within, you know, a little over 6 months from now, which I think we'd all agree is lightning fast by NCAA standards. Given where it is now, that there is a set of principles that says, you know, if a player doesn't cause his team to lose APR points, which is where that 2.6 GPA comes in, it's the threshold for earning probably the biggest and easiest to get exception when a player transfers to, so the school doesn't lose that APR point. If that's the principle, then there's really no way to not have something like that. They'd have to completely change kind of the philosophy that they're working under in crafting this. I think at this point we're really looking at the particulars. It might be that you only get one of those. Mm-hmm. So it's tied to a transfer exception called the one-time transfer exception, which is the big transfer exception that distinguishes, you know, the schools where we generally say players have to sit out when they transfer versus the sports where we generally say that players are allowed to transfer and play immediately. Whether it's good or not, I tend to come from the school of thought that the NCAA is a, you know, claims to be, and in my opinion, generally tries really hard to be an educational organization. And all of the data, all of the research shows that when kids with a 2.6 or higher GPA transfer, it's not nearly as bad of an academic event as players with below that GPA transferring. So I think it's a good carrot to put out for players, you know, to tell them, hey, if you don't think you're going to be happy at a school or you're having second thoughts, remember to focus on your classwork, because you're going to need to keep the GPA up in order to keep your options open. It's also not total free agency, because they're still going to have releases, although those releases are no longer going to be tied to player scholarships. They'll be tied to playing and practicing, so a kid's education won't be affected if a school refuses to grant his release. And I think, you know, if there's a broad group of athletes in men's basketball who are allowed to transfer and play immediately, I think there's the possibility that the players who aren't, haven't met that GPA requirement or haven't earned any sort of exception to transfer and play immediately, they're going to find it more difficult to transfer, especially, you know, in this, as people keep calling it, this quote-unquote free agency market of experienced talent.
Yeah, I think this is a broad stroke here, but I think if you've got players that, you know, the higher the grade, usually the smarter the person, right? And the smarter the person, usually the more level-headed, the more patient they are. So I think if you've got players that has a 2.9, I think generally he's less likely to transfer, because he usually has a broader perspective. This is not always the case, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, but I think it trends, and you've pointed to data that proves that that for, academically speaking, the 2.6 is a bit of a Mendoza line when it comes to this stuff. I also think that you stand to invite I don't know how widespread, but a little bit of academic fraud or cheating with players, if they can do it. Listen, if a guy's got like a 2.4 and he struggles and he thinks he can make his way to a 2.6 by cutting some corners, I would not doubt that that would happen as well. So you're inviting a little bit of potential controversy there, but you're just not going to stop that. I mean, there right now there could very well be plenty of players that are struggling to stay at a 2, you know, which I believe it's 2.0 to remain eligible, right, across the board?
Yeah, more or less. Like all things in the NCAA, it's a little more complicated than that. But if you have a 2.0, generally you're both eligible, but you need to be a little concerned.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't doubt that there are players that that do the best they can, whether it's inside or outside the lines, to remain eligible to play and stay above that 2 line. But it's interesting, man. I think I'm for it. I know a lot of people are against it. I had Doug Gottlieb come on the podcast, actually. I think he was my first guest after you broke the news. And he had mentioned that the coaches won't let it get to this point because they'll have to sign off on it. Is that entirely accurate?
Well, you know, certainly there's going to be a backlash when it's passed. I mean, the way things are, you know, the way legislation works in the NCAA during, you know, this period post this presidential retreat in 2011 is smaller groups, whether it's working groups that are working on a specific topic or the leadership council, in this case, working on this transfer issue, which is one AD from each conference, or the board of directors, which, you know, every conference isn't represented on, they're the ones who are creating and feeding this legislation up to the board of directors, who ultimately passes it. And then individual schools can basically object by filing what's called an override request.
Which happened, not to cut you off, but didn't this happen with recently with something else? You sent off a flare in my brain.
With both the stipend and multi-year scholarships.
Yes, so, exactly.
If enough schools submit an override request, then it goes to an override vote, which is an electronic vote where each school has one vote and you need a 5/8 majority of the schools who actually submit a vote to overturn the legislation. So basically, the way legislation works in the NCAA now is a small group passes it, and then if basically a supermajority objects to it, then they go back to the drawing board. So, you know, with the multi-year scholarships, we had a vote that came within one or two schools changing their vote would have caused that not to survive. And with the stipends, there was such an overwhelming number of schools that submitted a request to reconsider the legislation that the board of directors didn't even take it to an override vote and, again, withdrew it and went back to the drawing board. So to Gottlieb's point about the coaches signing off on it, there are certainly going to be some objections, and some of them are going to be able to convince their ADs and their university presidents to submit overrides and you know, if it comes to it, vote against the legislation in an override vote. However, I think, you know, the big thing that's still going to be in there for them is that they can still refuse to release a player, and the appeals of those releases are still going to be done within the school. So I think, you know, when we go back to last summer and we look at all the controversy surrounding coaches not giving releases, not letting players leave.
Like Bo Ryan.
For example, which is not technically true. They can't actually prevent a transfer. What they can do is prevent a kid from getting a scholarship for 1 year. I think, you know, it'll almost be more of a question for the public to say, if they can't touch the kid's scholarship anymore, if they can only really say, hey, if you want to leave, you can leave and you can get a scholarship anywhere, but I'm not going to release you to play immediately or to practice that first year. Will there be less public backlash when coaches decide to do that? Will we still accept if coaches, you know, have more specific restrictions like no one on our schedule for next year, or no one in the conference, or no one in the state? I think, you know, when you hear the ideas of coaches saying, well, I don't think anybody should be able to play, no waivers whatsoever, you know, everybody should have to sit out a year, that's a coach saying, I don't want to have to be the bad guy. I don't want to have to be the one who has to go and tell a kid he can't play and then defend that decision. I want to, you know, point to the big bad NCAA who says no waivers, can't do anything. Which every person who says that, I'm sure, you know, has good intentions, but I can create a sob story, some kid who suffered a parade of horribles that that you would say, well, yeah, I said no waivers, but that kid deserves a break. And then we're back to the same situation of, if that kid deserves a break, what about this kid who looks similar, but there's one little difference? Well, he deserves a break too. And then we just end up right back where we are right now with a seemingly inconsistent waiver process. So I do think there needs to be a sort of general exception. And if it's, you know, an academic bar, whether it's, you know, this 2.6 number where there's a lot of research behind, whether we say, you know, 2.6 is fine for a school not to lose APR points, but it should be a 3.0 for a kid who wants to be able to play immediately, is going to have to strive a little higher than that. I think is a decent compromise.
Agreed.
And you know, if you're a coach, then you know what, when you're getting those grade reports back from the academic staff, which guys are, you know, going to be able to leave or potentially might be targeted with some tampering because, you know, they're the ones who are eligible to go play immediately.
That's great stuff. John Infante, @John_Infante on Twitter. NCAA stuff can be sometimes just so laborious to try and to sift through, but you make it easier to understand. And these days, I mean, there are 7 or 8 topics the NCAA is dealing with right now that we don't even have the time to get into, and it speaks to the quagmire.
And that's not even with getting into the College Basketball Champions League either.
Exactly, the CBBCL, baby. I know, exactly. That's a whole other deal altogether. Well, listen, man, appreciate having you on. And we'll, you know, there will be plenty of times going forward we'll get you back on, whether, you know, this GPA thing passes, and we can talk about that in the future. But regardless, your wisdom is always appreciated. So thanks a lot, man.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
All right. Sounds good. We will be back Monday with another podcast. I am not yet sure of the guest. I'm trying to arrange that. I've got a few options out there, so it'll be a little surprise popping up in your subscription. If you are indeed subscribed to iTunes, feel free to do that. And I've gotten plenty of talk about how we are not yet on Stitcher. I'm aware of that, trying to make it happen very soon. So if you use that to listen to your podcasts, know that that is on the way. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you after the weekend.